Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Of all the comics who emerged from that Boston 1980s comedy club boom, few were more successful or quirky than Stephen Wright. Here he is. It's 1985, the album I Have a Pony.
For my birthday, I got a humidifier and a dehumidifier. I put them in the same room, let them fight it out.
Well, so Wright has written a novel. It's called Harold, and it takes place in the mind of a 7-year-old boy. And it is every bit what you would expect from Stephen Wright. I sat down with him last week, and I started with Harold's idea that people should have reverse birthdays, thinking life would be different if you knew ahead of time the day of the year on which you die.
Yes, it would be like bookends. And it would highlight the time, like it would magnify. If you knew the end, it would magnify. And the birthday, okay, the birthday, then the day you die, and then it would be like you get to celebrate. The day you die is like just appreciating that you even lived. But these things, you know, I'm writing the book and I'm making stuff up as I go along, just making it up. And then other things that have been in my head for years seep in like that. I thought of that years ago to write about it. Just like I became aware that you passing the day, you pass the date every year. Everybody does, but you don't know when it is.
Everybody, every year, passes the date in the calendar that will eventually be the day of the year that they die.
Yes, and so it just seeped into the book. I just put it in. I have Harold thinking, really, he's thinking what I think. I'm pouring everything into his head, like I'm using his head like a funnel, and I'm pouring what I think of life into that, because in the stand, I have a lot, there's a lot on my mind that wouldn't be stand-up. I mean, that wouldn't, stand-up jokes, you know, short little jokes to make the audience laugh out loud. There's other things in my head besides that. So when I started writing this, I realized I could pour all these other things into his mind. It sounds like you read the book. You saw that there's a lot of things that a 7-year-old could never even think of. But I
confess, I thought that several times.
it didn't bother me though. It was like, okay, I didn't care.
Okay, so there's so many places I want to go from there. The you pouring your thoughts in like a funnel, I'm going to put a pin in that because I'm going to come back to that in a second. But I want to stay with some of the images and devices that you use in the book, because one of the devices in the book is all the way through the book. Harold talks about the birds that fly into the rectangle in his brain and bring him these thoughts, the ones that we know are really coming from you. And he describes in great detail all these birds that bring these thoughts, some which are very clearly real birds and some which are very clearly not real birds, right? Although they're very real to Harold. Are you like a bird lover? Do you bird watch? Did you go research all these birds? Where do the birds come from? Because in some of your interviews, you also make bird references.
I do in the other interviews?
Yes. I don't know if you noticed that, but I did.
Well, I'm not a bird freak at all. I mean, I can see you read someone reading it thinking, oh, he must be so into birds, but I'm not. I mean, I like them, but I don't know a lot about their kinds and everything. You see, that's another thing that I had in my head several years ago, was like, I thought, well, how is my mind working? Not really. Of course, I know it really isn't like this, but your mind goes from one subject to the other. You're in the store and you think, oh my God, I got to call that guy. Oh my God, I wonder how tall Bobby Orr is. Oh my God, I wonder, you know. So I just made up this thing for myself that your head was full of thousands and thousands of tiny birds, and each one represented a thought. And there was a little rectangle in the middle of your brain, like a window frame, an empty picture frame. And if the bird flew, whatever bird threw the flew through there. The mine was like an indoor sky. If the bird happened to go through that window, then that's what you would think of. I mean, I just thought it out years ago, just, I don't even know why. And then again, when I started writing this, I had, oh, I know, I can have Harold do this. And it enabled me to go from one subject to the subject and like blame it on the birds.
And is that really how your brain works? Like the birds just flutter through and you go from subject to subject?
There's no birds in my brain. I'm just, let me get that straight. I'm just making up an analogy. That's what it is.
So I want to step back from Harold a little bit, but not a lot, because you talked about all these thoughts that you could put into Harold and into this book that don't go into your comedy. And I found myself thinking a lot as I was reading the book. You know, did you write this the way you write some of your jokes? And in some of the interviews that I read, you know, you talk about, especially in the early days, you would write, you know, the first time you went up, right? You did a 3-minute set, about half of the jokes were funny, the other half people didn't laugh at, and eventually you got rid of the other half and you wrote more. And, you know, at any given time, maybe you're trying out jokes, maybe a quarter or a third of them people laugh at. The rest, eventually, they don't. After 3 times, you get rid of them.
Yes.
I wondered, are those the thoughts that then you hold on to and they form things like maybe a book or an essay or is this an entirely other compartment in your brain?
It's a whole other thing. When I try, 1 in 3 jokes works. Passes the 3 times test and then it'll stay in the act. But the other ones that don't pass, they drift away. I don't even remember them anymore. But when the audience doesn't laugh at it, I don't think, oh, it wasn't funny. I still think it's funny, but they don't agree with me. And they're in charge. They're like editing the thing. But the jokes would come to me just wandering around in my life, going through whatever I'm doing. And I would see something and that would trigger something, or someone would say a word, or I'd read a word in a book and that would ricochet off into a joke. They would just like fall into my head. But the book was, I specifically sat down almost on a daily basis and just tried to write like a couple hundred words about what this kid would be doing. So that's how it was different. This was very focused. The stand-up is like rain, it just falls around.
You want to come home to Boston for a little bit? Talk about Boston?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Burlington, Massachusetts, and then I went to school in Boston, Emerson College. And before that, I went to Middlesex Community College in Bedford. And then I stayed in Boston like 5 years and started doing comedy there. And then I moved to Hollywood for 2 years, then New York for 7 years, then back to Hollywood for 12 years. And then I wanted to go home back to New England. So I've been here like 22 years. Because the United States is so big. It's like one name, the United States, but it's so different. Like Florida and New England, a complete Colorado, Nevada. It's like they're different countries. And then living in Los Angeles, and I wanted to go back to the country of New England, of Massachusetts.
You've been a Red Sox fan all that time. I saw an interview you did with Conan O'Brien. You were wearing your Red Sox cap. Our producer, Rob Lane, pointed this one out to me. It's just before the Sox finally break the curse, and you compare their journey every season to the voyage of the Titanic.
I did.
You did, actually. Well, and yes. Of course, none of us knew that year, right? None of us knew that
yes.
was, yeah. Go.
2004, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, 2004, the Titanic reaches New York instead.
Actually makes it there. So are you enjoying the Sox this season?
I am enjoying it, but what frustrates me is the lineup is so completely different. It's taking me like couple months to even be familiar with these new people. But that's my favorite sport. So, I mean, I follow if they won or lost. I went into Fenway Park about a month ago to see a game, and I follow it. I like it.
What else do you...
That's a pretty big thing of being in the present. If you're watching it, if you're really focused on that, you're not even thinking about your life. it's a great distraction.
So why did you want to come back to New England? What about, you know, I think you called it the United States of New England, makes this feel most like home to you?
You know, the seasons, definitely. The arc, the buildings, the vibe of it. It's just, it is, the whole country is like eight countries named one country. And you just get attached to, you're from here, aren't you from here?
Actually, I've been here 30 years, but I was raised in Michigan.
So do you want it, does something in your gut tell you that you want to go back to Michigan?
No, I love it here.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't love Los Angeles.
I get that. I will join you in dissing Los Angeles, actually. Yeah. And I love the Red Sox. I'll join you in that one, too.
Yes.
Yeah. So I want to ask you something about sort of the comedy environment when you came up in it. So you became a professional comedian in 1979, if I have my year right.
Well, no. I mean, I was going to the open mic nights, and I was doing shows for like $8 a night. It took me a couple of years to be able to pay the rent from doing it.
So when that happened, and as you were coming up, it sounds like it was an environment where there were lots of places you could perform. You might be able to do more than one show a night, lots of other comedians cutting their teeth. Like, what it made me think of, Stephen, is, you know, the Beatles in Germany in those early years when they had lots of chances to perform, lots of chances to make mistakes, lots of chances to sort of get shaped by their environment. Do you think you kind of came up in comedy in a unique time and in a unique time in Boston comedy?
Yes, very lucky, weird timing, like, because, you know, you weren't in New York, you weren't in L.A., and the club opened up in 78, I think, and I, Comedy Connection, and I went there in 79, and all the comedians, everyone went there in 79, and there was no show business in Boston. There was no managers, producers. No one could say, oh, you should do it like that. We were like on an island. We were doing, just trying to do it, trying to learn from doing it. And in the early 80s, comedy was all over the place. So there were comedy clubs, but even bars and restaurants that had two nights or three nights of comedy. So you could go from one to the other and to the other to the other. You know, in one night, you could do three sets. And, you know, from doing anything over and over again, you definitely learn. Absolutely. It was a lucky timing thing for us at that time.
When you started, you were by your own description, really an introvert. Something must have driven you to get up on a stage and try to be funny. I have heard that one of the most terrifying things there is, I mean, we know how afraid people in America are of public speaking, right? They're almost afraid of it as they are of dying, right?
Yes.
What on earth gave you enough drive to overcome your introversion to get on stage and try to be funny for people?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I would watch The Tonight Show all the time, starting when I was 16. And then I loved Johnny Carson, and I loved the comedians he had on there. I'd never seen comedians, Robert Klein, David Brenner, Carlin, of course. And these guys would come out and talk about life and make all this funny stuff up about being a lot, just experiencing life, and then sit down and talk to Johnny. And I got it in my head after a couple of years of watching this, that this would be my real dream. I would love to do that. So I have this absolute love, desire to do this, but I'm an introvert, and like everyone else, I'm horrified by public speaking. But I wanted to try it so bad that I forced myself. I went up. I was so nervous. I was nervous for years. I was nervous, but I wanted to see if I could do it so bad that I just made myself do it.
What's left to do?
I don't know. I don't really. I never planned anything out. I never planned, like, I should do a movie now. I should do this album. It was just all evolved. I don't know. It's something else will come, like, because the ideas, you might not have an idea for a while, but then it comes, like I said before, like rain. It might not rain for a little while, but you know it's going to rain.
Do you miss Harold now that the book's written?
If very, very interesting question. I don't miss him because he's so much still in my mind because I'm constantly talking about him to do these interviews. But it was interesting you say that because I created this little world and it got to be like, I know it's not real, but it was like I was hanging out with this little boy. Did you feel like that?
Yeah. I mean, you're spending a day in a kid's head, right? You're hanging out with him in the most personal way you can.
Yes.
That was comedian and now author Stephen Wright. His new novel, Harold, is out now from Simon & Schuster.